You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan of the Heralds of the Gospel. Today we're going to talk about a more historic theme. We're going to speak about something which makes our Christian faith so important. But this is what identifies Christians, identifies the various churches, unites them or divides them. And the historicity of it gives us a perspective. If you live in the United States or in many other places around the world, on Sundays, the creed that is prayed is the Nicene Creed or the Constantinopolitan Nicene. This was a creed that was created out of the Council of Nicaea. Of the various councils that happened in Nicaea, and then was further combed in Constantinople, the councils in Constantinople. But we're going to look at the First Council of Nicaea, and then from there look at how that formed and why that was important. And I believe when we get into the councils, we're going to be on this for a while because the councils are, mostly the first councils, are incredibly important to our understanding of our faith. Particularly because without which the Catholic faith that we have today was under attack by internal and external enemies. Internal ones, they would be your garden variety of heretics that existed, and there are plenty of them. And then we ended up with the external forces, so governments, false converts, and the like. So we end up with two groups, and with the two groups, you end up with a very strange, you might say, test tube of sorts, different varieties of issues that are coming out the same time and are applying pressures that are amazing. We look back at it and say, well, they gathered for a gathering of bishops, and lo and behold, things moved forward. That really isn't an authentic view. So let's start off, and let's take a quick view, and then we'll dig in as much as possible. So Nicaea also has this element about it that it is the first of the ecumenical councils. And it's held in 325. Why is it the first? Well, one of the big problems that the church had suffered for the first 300 years was intermittent persecutions by the state. The church continued to grow, which historically we know, but it was something which was continual. It was every couple of decades, there would be another persecution, more martyrs. Aurelian, Diocletian, Decius, Trajan, so on and so forth. So to have a gathering of bishops would be very, very difficult. So Nicaea really gathers around to fight against this heresy coming out of Alexandria called Arianism, or this guy called Arius. So let's do a little bit of background. So as early as 320, Bishop of Alexandria, Alexander, who was canonized, is known as Saint Alexander, he convoked a council in his own diocese of Alexandria, in which more than 100 bishops from Egypt, Libya, anathematized Arius. Now, anathematize is a way of excommunicating and cursing someone who is considered out of the church. Arius will continue to officiate in his church and recruit followers. Finally, he is driven out of Alexandria, and he sets up shop in Palestine. And then from there, he goes to Nicomedia. Nicomedia was a large city in Asia Minor at that time. It's during that time that St. Alexander publishes his famous epistle. And it's to that epistle that Arius will respond. And then from there, the quarrel went beyond possibly having human controls. Different councils will also look at this argument and discuss it. So in Bithynia, they talk about this epistle of Alexander. So in that council, they addressed an encyclical to all the bishops, asking them to receive the Arians into communion with the church. Soon there was war, and this is where the political side, to internal and external, the era of the three emperors, the tetrarchy, is falling apart. We have Constantine defeating Maximus and what have you, and now we finally have Constantine versus Licinius. So this adds to the layers of problems going on at the same time. So you have the Holy Roman Empire, which exits the crisis of the 3rd century, goes into Diocletian, its persecutions, and then we end up with the three emperors, and then we have Constantine destroying the three emperors and instituting himself as the only emperor. So after Constantine wins his battles, we end up having him write letters to St. Alexander and to Arius. And trying to find a means for them to agree with each other to cause peace. He wants peace. Peace almost at any cost. He wants peace. So what becomes very evident in all of the work of Constantine in this issue is that he really has no concept about the theological problems that Arius has. And he sends a Spaniard to speak with the warring parties, and it comes to nothing. And they don't know what to do, so they decide to call a council, gather all the bishops together in one place, and with that, to solve this problem, give peace to the empire, and allow Constantine to build his vision of his empire. So he asks, that's Constantine, asks the bishops of the known world to come to Nicaea. So bishops also from outside of the empire come to Nicaea. And this was very interesting because until this point, bishops from outside the empire really, A, would not go to something within the empire because they were scared of being seen as a fifth column. And this will add fuel to what happens later on when there are divisions within the Christian church on empire or nation bases, because this becomes the core issue. When this council was called, what wasn't clear was that the emperor call it solely on his own prerogative and power, or was it with that consent and authority of the Pope in Rome? We do know that various other major archbishops, for Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, many of them used the term also of Pope. And until today, the Coptics use the word Pope. So anyone who was near the Mediterranean basin, Nicaea was an excellent choice, being a large city for accommodations, but also that it was accessible by port. So the amount of bishops fluctuate drastically. We have Eusebius coming in at 250, and we have later Arabic manuscripts raising the number to 2,000 bishops. Which is pretty evident that it's a little bit of the story that the Italians would say, we call it Milicani. So it's the idea that someone comes and tells a story about one dog barking, and then that story is retold and then retold again, and then eventually there are 1,000 dogs barking. So that's kind of where we are. So we have bishops who come with their priests, acolytes, and their deacons. And so that number is amazing. So amongst them, St. Athanasius is present. And St. Athanasius will be the successor of St. Alexander. And St. Athanasius is inspired by the example and life of the great hermit of the desert, St. Anthony. And this is very important because the core of the issue of this council is based on the heresy of what Arius is preaching. What is Arianism? Arianism is a heresy which takes a look at the person of Christ, and I would say, the best way of putting it I've heard is Hellenizing it. We know that Alexandria was a city that was founded by, of course, Alexander. Of course, it's Egyptian. But these people are amazingly Hellenized. They're amazingly Greekophiles. Though people didn't necessarily believe in the Greek mythology, they did use it as a means of understanding. Some people put it as a tool of philosophy. It was an argument, it's argument basis for many things. So if we look at this interpretation of what Jesus Christ is, according to Arius, it makes more sense. So Jesus Christ, Son of the Father, but our Lord himself said he was not equal to the Father. What they couldn't understand was Jesus Christ in a hypostatic relationship with his humanity. That he was 100% human and 100% divine. So what did Arius do? He made Jesus Christ into a type of Hercules, a type of demigod. And in doing that, Jesus Christ has fully human, but with like divine highlights. He has elements to him which are that of God, but he's not God. He's not of the same substance. He's not substantially God. He is of another thing. He's human. Now, you can pretty much see where this problem is going. This problem is going in a rather bad direction. But this gets worse, because with this, the person of Mary gets trampled, because Mary is merely the mother of the human part of Jesus. You can see that many Protestant churches have a great affinity with Arius, because Arius is far closer theologically to him, to them, than we will see with Athanasius, or with Alexander, or with Anthony the Abbot. And the problem is that we strip Jesus of his divinity. We end up with a great salvific crisis point. And that salvific crisis point is that if Jesus was man with godlike accents, of what value was his offering on the cross? Because if his offering on the cross was that of a human, it was not infinite. And since the fault that occurred with our first parents was a sin against God, who is infinite, the recompense, the one who was going to offer in our place to fix this fault, had to have had the same element of the infinite. You can't fill an infinite hole with finite items. It just doesn't fit. It doesn't work. So we end up with a salvific issue. Now, Arianism was very popular, and this will later become a real pain for the church. And I'm jumping ahead of myself, but the church will end up condemning officially in council Arius and his heresy, and kicking those people who are Arians out. And they will wander on the edges of the empire, in which they will end up converting a lot of the barbarian tribes. Why is it that the barbarian tribes like Arius? They like him for another reason, is that the chief of these tribes will identify himself closely with God the Father, that he is Father God, he is the boss, he is the head. And the church will be a supple servant, the son. He will do the will of the Father, of his Father, of the King. So we end up with the very first kernels of what will become a real problem in the East of Caesar papism, in which the boss, the head, the king, emperor of a place is the head of the church. The separation between the church and the state, or having the church influence the state without being dominated, is what the goal of the medieval project was in Europe. But this gives us a tremendous amount of pain in the East. So whatever emperor is boss, is at the head, whatever tribe is coming through, they will be Arian. Arian fit better, the theology of Arianism fit better to their own barbaric customs. But Arius takes on the salvation question, which is first. The second question that it brings a problem to is the actual sacramental side. As we believe as Catholics, the sacraments are given to us by Christ, visible signs of God's grace. Now, if Jesus Christ was only God like part of the time, for a portion of the time, then of what value are his sacraments? The Eucharist, the greatest of all the sacraments, the source and summit of the Christian life. What's there? If Jesus Christ is not God, body, blood, soul, and divinity, then we're really in trouble, because the Eucharist doesn't have its value. Now, the Arian heresy will wreak havoc throughout the eastern area, the eastern part of the Mediterranean basin. But what happens is that because of the political situation, Athanasius will be expelled time and time again from his see. Remember another thing, that Alexandria was the richest city in the Roman Empire. And the wheat that was grown along the banks of the Nile by irrigation was the most plentiful source of grain found in the known world. One of the ways that the emperors in Rome would keep everyone happy and content was that they would give them free grain. It was like grain dole. And with that, they would solve, you know, the problem of uprisings. One of the reasons why Rome falls so quickly from its pinnacle of power and influence is when the government can no longer afford or has means to give that grain dole, and there isn't any food because of the structure of the city. The city was made a city of imports. Importing wealth, importing food, importing slaves, importing everything. It wasn't a city that made things. It controlled, it governed, but it did not. So slowly but surely, when the emperors decide that Rome wasn't adequate for what they wanted, Rome begins its descent because it doesn't make anything. It is inland. It's not a trading port. So it costs more to bring things in. And with that, it ends up becoming an issue going forward. So you look at it, you understand what we mean here is Alexandria was of great, great importance. It was very rich. It was the intellectual hub. It was where a Greek philosophy was spoken and used. We will have later on the case of Hypatia of Alexandria, one of the first women philosophers, which isn't the case, not the first, because there were others. And as many historians say, that the story of Hypatia is a little exaggerated, like a lot. It wasn't exactly as what the pagan historians said. We know, for example, of the family of St. Gregory Nazianzen, that he would say that the best philosopher, and he was one of the best of his era, and he'll be at the Council of Nicaea, was his sister, Macrina, and their mother. Then they learned everything from their mother and their sister, and they're putting their sister as on par with the greatest minds that they had ever bumped into in Asia Minor. So the person of Christ, this becomes a big, big issue, because how many persons does Jesus contain? Of what substance? Of what hymenousis? And this becomes an issue that goes from this council in 325 right up until 500. It becomes an ongoing, tumbling argument of sorts. Arianism will will kind of open the doors to the major heresies, which are, there are three major ones at this era. One is Arianism, of course, where you deny that Jesus is God, that he is a type of demigod. We have Nestorianism, which was the patriarch of Constantinople. He goes in the opposite direction and says that Jesus is all God and not man. Which is also an error. And actually, it's funny because both errors, if you smash them together, they're actually very similar because the same problems pop up with both. And we have another one called Docetism. And Docetism is the heresy which denies that Jesus Christ truly had a human body, that he appeared to be human, but he remained as God, kind of like a ghosty type idea. And again, this brings back the same issue. And this is in the Council of Chalcedon, a later council, where they declare Mary as Mother of God, Theotokos. This becomes a pole, a peg that everything else is built on. And they said it, and they would say during that council that good Christology, good study of Christ, is based on a very good Mariology. Because if the person of Mary is well situated and well understood, then the person of Christ has a place. Another way of looking at it is that the Christ and the person of Christ is protected by the hedge of good Mariology. When the Marian element is torn asunder, then Christ loses what he is. And we can see that within the Protestant churches, where they have thrown away Our Lady's position. And now you end up in a situation where you have we're not sure about anything. There is no virginal birth. There's no this. There's no that. Christ is, I've heard in certain low church Protestant denominations, I think some of their lines, they would have made Arius blush in their positions. So we have to be very clear with these points. And it's good for us to learn about Arianism, because these reflect basic problems that people have with the Christological issues of every day. Remember, if we deny Jesus has a humanity, then his sacrifice, how can a God suffer? How can a God die? How can Mary be his mother? True. If he's only God, there is no way for that. Let's flip it. If he's only man, what's special about him having a mother? His suffering is finite. He cannot redeem us. So we end up in that situation. So it's something that's really, really rather interesting, because if we don't understand it, then we end up in a problem. So they go through many controversies. One of the times was the timing of the celebration of Easter. They go through it's a mega, the Council of Nicaea is one of those huge councils. It's major in a sense of housekeeping. They're really putting everything out there and saying, okay, so we're going to situate this in such a manner that we're going to see. So we're going to go to a break now, and when we come back, we will continue with our conversation about Arius. We'll be right back.
You are listening to the Catechism Hour here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. Nicaea. The term would be Nicene Christian. Those who came under the canons or the rule or the points of the Council of Nicaea who agreed with them would be known as Nicene Christians. They were proper Christians. They were Orthodox Christians. Then others would be non-Nicene and they would be Arians, for example. Later on, everyone would use as the touchstone when every controversy would be the Council of Nicaea said this. They also acted on issues on bishops. This later will be lifted. Why was it first placed? It was placed because they had a problem of bishops kind of hopscotching their way across. So they become a bishop at a small place and then sort of make a power play to get into the bigger places. So the idea in the Council of Nicaea was that bishops would be appointed for life in a diocese. So you were appointed Archbishop of Constantinople. You went from being a monk or a priest to Archbishop of Constantinople. You didn't have prior positions. This is lifted later on, and a Catholic today would hear this and saying, but that doesn't make a lot of sense. Best practices. You want a bishop to have been somewhere else, training, having experience, and then moving across to a larger diocese. But that was what the council forbade. So when we have cases of bishops who, because of the influence of an emperor, end up becoming the really it was the best diocese in the world, which was Constantinople. You were close to the emperor, a lot of money, nice churches, what have you. And if he was a bishop somewhere else, there was already a problem. And because of the canon of Nicaea, they would be illegitimate. They would be deposed. The emperor was able to depose. And that later on will be lifted because abuses were aplenty. So in the canon, from the formulation of the one of the first formulations of the creed runs like such. We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of all things visible and invisible, and in one Lord Jesus Christ, only begotten of the Father, that of the substance of oesis, of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of same substance with the Father, omnisciens de patris, through whom all things were made, both on earth and on in heaven, who for us men in our salvation descended, was incarnate, and was made man, suffered and rose again on the third day, ascended into heaven, and cometh to judge the living and the dead, and in the Holy Spirit, those who say there is no time when he was not. He was not before he was begotten, and that he was not made, and that he was made out of nothing, ex ontend, or those who maintain that he is of another hystasis, or another substance in the Father, or that the Son is created, or mutable, or change. The Catholic Church anathematizes them. So we end up with this council, which really gives form to the Catholic Church. People who the ones who really don't like the Catholic Church, those who have issues with the positions, will claim that Constantine founded the church in the Council of Nicaea. It's very hard to say that he founded a church that you have on the extreme end, which is probably an exaggeration of 2,000 bishops, 250 Eusebius says, which is closer to what would be. there were hundreds of bishops in the Mediterranean basin. There were bishops all over the place. There were bishops in Armenia. There were bishops in what would be later Poland, Germany, Spain, North Africa, Persia, all over the place. To say that Constantine founded it is quite a stretch. Oh, I forgot about India. So, no, he did not found the Catholic Church. So let's go through some of the canons. There are 20 more than 20 canons, but these are important. So canon one, it talks about the admission or support and expulsion of clerics who have been mutilated. I guess that was a big issue. A lot of times this happened to rival families in which they would mutilate a contrary contestant or one of their own family who was barring the succession of someone more promising, and they would mutilate them and then throw them into a monastery and make them a priest because they could. This was a way of barring that, stopping this practice, this barbaric practice. Number two, rules were to be ordained, observed during ordination. The avoidance of undue haste, again, this pressure. The deposition of those guilty of a grave fault. Canon three, all members of the clergy are forbidden to dwell with any woman except a mother, sister, or aunt. Again, they're trying to move the clergy to the monastic principle. Canon 4, concerning episcopal elections. Canon 5, concerning the excommunicate. Number 6, concerning patriarchs and their jurisdiction. This was a big issue. This was something that was important to have finally hammered out. And they did, and as I already mentioned. 7, confirms the rights of the bishops of Jerusalem to enjoy certain honors. This was to make sure that Jerusalem kept its honors. It had been depopulated in the past. Jerusalem is the holy city, and they wanted to make sure that it had its proper position. Number 8 is another group of heretics, the Novatians, and I will go to them later on to talk about them. They're actually rather interesting. Not as interesting as Arians, but they're interesting. Number 9. Certain sins known after ordination involve invalidation. This was a period that they had certain sins that could be that were hidden that would invalidate the sacrament because of a problem in the matter and form. Canon 10. The lapsi, who have been ordained knowingly and must be excluded as soon as their irregularity is known. This was a problem with the Donatists, and this will come to a head later on in the 400s, so 100 years later, with Augustine, in which the lapsi were those who had given up the faith because of persecution, and then they came back. This is a point where they're saying, this is not right. They shouldn't be ordained as priests and bishops. Later on, with Augustine saying that God's grace is such great, and moving that forward, giving them the possibility of forgiveness. Canon 11. Penance to be imposed on apostates of the persecution of Licurius. So this is a persecution, and what they're going to do to those who apostatized during that period. Canon 12, penance to be imposed on those who upheld Licurius during his war on the Christians. So those who lined up with Licurius who was persecuting the Christians. Canon 13, indulgence to be granted to the excommunicated persons in the danger of death. Again, you want, for their good of their soul, you want them to come back. And this was very important. Canon 13, the indulgence to be granted. Okay, I'm sorry. Canon 14, penance to be imposed on catechumens who have become weakened during persecution. Again, this is an era of a grave. I mean, penances were severe in that era. So this is to be understood. Canon 15, bishops, priests, deacons are not to pass from one church to another. And that's what I was talking about, the question of the episcopacy, because they didn't want these wandering groups. And what they were really scared of was that people would people would migrate towards the larger centers, and it would become these little courts for these bishops, what have you. And then the little people on the outside would be forgotten. Canon 16. All clerics are forbidden to leave their church. Formal prohibition for bishops to ordain for their diocese a cleric belonging to another diocese. Same problem. Clerics, number 17. Clerics are forbidden to lend on interest. Canon 18. Recalls to deacons their subordinate position in regard to priests. And this was a problem that happens time and time again, which is that positions... people forget where they're supposed to be. They don't know their place. Canon 19. Rules to be observed in regard to the adherents of Paul of Samosata who wished to return to the church. Again, another group that had gone into heresy and they had gone far. And 20. On Sundays and during Paschal season, prayers that should be said standing. So these are really important items. So everything ends up being with one point. And it's always interesting. St. Athanasius fought like a lion against the Arian push and counter-pushes and the politicians of the day who found that Arius fit better in their own vision of things. He spent his whole life in one long theological debate about apparent minutiae. And that's why minutiae is so important, because it's the small stuff that sometimes is so important. St. Athanasius, when he dies, after his death in 373, the Second Ecumenical Council convened in Constantinople in 381. Constantius II had long passed from the scene, and Theodosius II ruled over the Eastern Empire, and that was from 379 to 395. And he actually had enough of these Arians, and he wanted to get rid of them. So we see this Arian heresy fermented and fomented throughout the church. So when we see things that are bad, and we see it's been around for 20, 30 years, you know, we got to acknowledge that, you know, we got to have time. In Constantinople II, any potential nod to Arianism or even a wink at it was put out of the church once and for all. So finally, the second Constantinople, you had Nicaea, Constantinople I, and Constantinople II, they finally had enough of these elements. They finally put them out. Athanasius's view of Christ as being of one substance or essence, homoiesis, with the Father won the day, and while Arius's view of Christ as a similar substance with the Father, and this is where you have the problem of the eye, one has an eye, one doesn't, was declared to be outside the bounds of orthodoxy and was thus condemned. So you may say that Athanasius wasted his life, and only after his death did his position become vindicated. And in truth, much more. You know, you might ask about Athanasius, saying, you know, he wasted his time, endured so much, deposed from his diocese so many times over a single letter. But why would he wrangle over a single letter for so long? The reason is in the phrase that is found in the Nicene Creed, a phrase that was inserted by Athanasius. It may be not too much of a stretch to claim that this phrase to be the most profound, if not the most beautiful, of all the phrases in theological literature for us in our salvation. Athanasius was fighting with the best theological minds of the day. He endured persecution at the hands of the most powerful politicians of his day. And all of this for the sake of the gospel and the truth of Jesus Christ. He was persecuted for the person of Christ. And that is who Athanasius had placed his trust. If the church got Christ wrong, the church would be wrong on the work of Christ. So Athanasius spends 6 decades contending for a letter and contending against the world for the sake of the gospel. So when people say, oh, it was easier in the old days, I'm not so sure about that. So the Council of Nicaea in 325, Constantinople, 381, emphatically affirmed the divine and human natures of Christ. The Nicene Creed declares Christ's divinity and deity. He is very God, God of God. And Christ's humanity, he was made man. The Creed further and rather eloquently declares that this view of the person of Christ has everything to do with the work of Christ. He is the God-man for us and our salvation. And this is so very, very important, because for us to understand our basic element of Christ, our element of understanding the Eucharist, the idea of understanding the salvific value of baptism, we have to make clear that Christ is God. And this was something that they fought over year after year. So we look at Athanasius. In the Council of Nicaea, we look at Athanasius, and the terms that they used for him were, if disrespectful is a word, they did worse. They used to refer to Athanasius as the black dwarf. He wasn't terribly tall, and his skin was of a darker complexion. Racism hasn't gone out of fashion. But that didn't stop him. That didn't stop the situation. That he continued. And he preached Christ, Christ crucified, Christ, God, man, in France, in northern Italy, in what would become Switzerland. And in those areas, they didn't have the problems. When the famous epistle of Leo came out, which unfortunately went over the same points, the Church of the West kind of said, you know, we really don't have an issue. We really don't have an issue. We are fine. We understand who Christ is. So with that, we need to understand in truth all that we understand and put in the hands of Christ. The God-man, the great understanding. So hopefully we'll see you next week, and we'll continue looking at these controversies which formed our Christian faith and made us into the church we are today. May God bless you. Oh,
You've been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.